I'm Bob Schieffer.
And I'm Andrew Schwartz of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and this is the truth of the matter.
This is the podcast where we break down the policy issues of the day. Since the politicians are having their say, we will excuse them with respect and bring in the experts, many of them from CSIS, people who have been working these issues for years.
No spin, no bombast, no finger pointing, just informed discussion. In today's episode of The Truth of the Matter, I'm flying solo as Bob Schieffer is out of town. To get to the truth of the matter about U.S. international energy policy and climate change, I have two of my favorite colleagues. I have Sarah Ladislau, who heads our energy program, and Nikos Safos, who is a big part of our energy program, too. Guys, I want to ask you, CSIS recently launched a new initiative, Climate Smart Foreign Policy, to spearhead work on U.S. leadership on climate change internationally. What inspired the initiative, and what do you hope to achieve with it?
Yeah, thanks so much, Andrew, for having us on. You're one of our favorite colleagues, too. So it's always nice to have a chance to talk to you. Yeah, so we launched this initiative called Climate Smart Foreign Policy for a couple of different reasons. You know, one is CSIS is such a multifaceted organization that thinks about security from so many different dimensions. You know, I think people know that we're one of the top rated, you know, think tanks that deals with international security issues, but I don't think they always appreciate the breadth and the depth of the things that we cover. And as a climate expert, you know, one of the things that I noticed looking around the center is like, we're actually covering climate change in so many different programs, whether it's on the humanitarian side or on the development side or the security side or even the trade and economic side. Because climate change has become such a pervasive issue in so many public policy and even private sector activities, we really are covering it in a lot of different ways. The big gap is the fact that the United States does not have a coherent policy for dealing with climate change. And part of that is because it's just a very divisive issue. It's a more divisive issue among elite policymakers than it is among the American public in general, in fact. And that's something that I think a public policy institution like ourselves should be able to help out with. And so we launched this initiative for a few reasons. One, we wanted to highlight all the good work that's going on in CSIS on the issue of climate change. But two, we really wanted to find ways to overcome some of the challenges related to U.S. engagement on a consistent basis and, quite frankly, taking a leadership role in thinking about climate change. And so we saw a number of opportunities to do that. You know, first and foremost, if policymakers or foreign policy people tend to think about climate change as something that they don't understand, as something that people in the climate community understand, but really what they need to do is start incorporating that into the way that they think about their own field. So, for example, we've got some work going on in the trade program that's looking at the entire global trade agenda is up for grabs. It's being rewritten. Well, how do we put climate change priorities into that agenda? All of our alliances and security arrangements, those are being refigured. Well, one of the big issues that everybody's going to have to deal with, including the United States, is how we deal with impacts from climate change. And so we really think that we're in a great position to be able to help on a bipartisan basis think about how we craft a more durable foreign policy platform from the United States that thinks about how we deal with climate change in a more robust way.
Sarah, is there real energy in Congress and in the administration to do things on a bipartisan basis in this space?
Yeah, I think there is. And I think, you know, it's become a little cliche to say, oh, Republicans are interested in trying to find a way to say yes to climate. But quite frankly, I think a lot of what we've just gone through in the COVID-19 pandemic and unfortunately continue to go through is a lot of policymakers realizing that they have to think strategically about what's in the long-term interest of the United States. And if we've always known that pandemics could be a threat and that we perhaps are not as resilient as we want to be and we're not preparing for them well, climate change is another very large threat that we know is not only on the horizon, it's here and now with us, and we're really not prepared. And so by broadening the conversation away from just, can we meet very stringent emissions reduction goals by X date certain, which is usually where most of the conversation is, but to how do we prepare for all of the things that a changing climate means for our society, for our security forces, for how we think about our economy, you actually allow for more room for people to get involved. And so what we're seeing is by broadening that sort of approach, you allow for entry points for people who may come at this issue from a different perspective. And that does tend to energize people along a broader political spectrum.
Nikos, I want to ask you, in a similar vein, your program thinks a lot about great power competition and its relationship with energy. And you recently released Race to the Top, which is a report that outlines a new international energy policy for the United States. What's driving your assertion that the U.S. needs a new international energy strategy?
Well, thank you for having us, Andrew. The short answer is that the world has changed and we need to adapt to that new world. The world is changing in lots of different ways, but our report focus on four big changes. One is the United States is now a large oil and gas producer, the largest in the world. So for the last 40, 50 years, we've set up policies, institutions, mental models, all geared or premised on the fact that the United States is the largest importer of energy and the largest consumer of energy. Well, that's no longer the case. So we need a strategy that recognizes that the United States is starting from a very different perspective. That's one. The second is the energy system is changing. Fossil fuels, oil, gas, coal, they're still dominant in the energy supply of the world. But they are being increasingly supplemented by renewable energy technologies, solar, wind, electric batteries, electric vehicles. And so we have a diffusion of these new technologies. And of course, you have the imperative of climate change, that the energy system is not only changing, but it has to change even faster than it already is. The third thing is we have growing recognition that this liberal, democratic, capitalist system that we all assumed the world was going to converge to, well, the world isn't really converging to that endpoint. And so you have rival economic and political systems that are not only emerging, but they're thriving and they're posing a challenge for the United States. And lastly, you have economic competition. Now, obviously, economic competition is not a new thing, but you have two things that make it feel new. One is the United States feels less sure that it is winning economic competition. I mean, you look at this country and anything from economic inequality to the pace of innovation to the ability to provide for the most vulnerable parts of the society, high healthcare costs, you know, one can go on and on. You have a sense that you're not really winning. And in the past, economic competition, it was always with allies. You know, it's one thing to argue with West Germany and Japan, and it's a whole other ballgame to argue with China and to think about what China means. And so you need to have an international energy policy where you don't think like a consumer and an importer, but you think as a producer. You don't focus exclusively on fossil fuels, but you think about renewable energy technologies, where you're not thinking about how do you shepherd this world towards an agreed upon liberal capitalist system, but you have to contend with different ways of running an economy. And you have to do this at a time where you feel less secure about the economic position of the United States vis-a-vis these other countries. And so all these things mean that there's no sort of turning back to the old, because you have to craft a strategy that begins from a totally different perspective than where the United States has started over the last 50 years.
So I want to ask you along those lines, Nikos. We're about to have an election in November. And if there's a change in administration or whether this current administration gets reelected, what would you advise whoever the next administration is, again, whether it's Donald Trump or Joe Biden, what would be the first thing they need to do to engineer a new energy strategy?
The way we thought about this is there are two components to an international energy strategy. The first is you got to be competitive at home. You just really cannot hope to lead the world in energy and climate if you are not at the forefront of technological innovation, if you are not the most competitive you can be, if you are not really at the forefront of the new technologies and innovations that are going to power what the energy system is going to look like in 20, 30 years. So that's one pillar. The second pillar is to think about how do you revitalize this multilateral system that we have spent 70-something years building up, and not just saying, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we went back to a world that no longer exists, but how do you give it a new purpose? And this is what Sarah was talking about. If you think about what global challenge can rival climate change in terms of its breadth, its scope, its ability to touch everything that we do around the world. And so one of the things we talk about in the report a lot is how do you infuse climate throughout the system? How do you think about what does doing something on climate mean for the World Trade Organization? What does it mean for the IMF? What does it mean for the Food and Agricultural Organization? And more importantly, one of the things we've said is this isn't about creating a new structure. This isn't about creating the World Climate Organization. It's thinking about what each organization out there is going to do in order to help us cope with this new world. And one of the key elements of that strategy is you got to make the multilateral system safe at a time where the big powers may not get along with each other. You cannot have a system where if the US and China are on opposite sides, nothing happens. This system won't be able to accomplish much. So we see a great role for civil society. We see a great role for private industry. We see a great role for smaller groupings that want to move along faster. But all these will only flourish if you have leadership from the United States. And so, you know, there's a domestic component that we can get into. But on the international front, the key thing is to think about the role that climate can play in revitalizing and in giving purpose to an international system that we have set up after all these years, and that frankly sometimes seems to lack purpose and vigor, and climate could be a new mission for it.
Sarah, let me ask you about the domestic part of the strategy. What do you think?
I agree with Nikos, and maybe to be really pointed about it, you know, we need to speak to the U.S. political system where it is. We need to stop waiting for power of wishful thinking, right? That, you know, all of a sudden everybody's going to come to the same place and agree that climate change needs to be the lens through which we think about all of our interactions on energy. Like, that will be true for one party. It will not be true for the other for a while. And so one of the perspectives we took for this approach was, right now, the United States is on the precipice of going in a very dangerous and damaging direction, which is to take a look at competitiveness around the world in the energy space and to go, we need to compete with Russia and China the way they play, right? We need to go compete with them in third countries and try and do this foreign policy tit for tat. And it just doesn't make a ton of sense, right? We're talking about protectionist measures here in the United States to keep them out of our supply chain. All of that's fine when it has a national security imperative tied to it. The problem that we see is that the United States is not trying hard enough to just be competitive. Like, if we want to win something, we have to try. And right now, we have an absence of a strategy. And so we were really moved by this idea that the U.S. is at its most powerful and its most effective when we try really hard to do something that's in our own national self-interest, but also has benefits for the global community. And so we think this idea of a race to the top has to fundamentally start with the United States deciding that it really does want to compete in the area of new energy technologies, which is what Nikos has talked about. All these people complaining about the way that China unfairly subsidizes a bunch of industries that we, quite frankly, are neglecting. We don't give them enough money for research and development. We don't put the policies in place to make sure that those technologies make it to market. And we just have this, you know, sort of magic wand called the free markets that we hope is going to make some sort of a decision that will yield us to that outcome. I have no idea why the United States has such an aversion to trying to talk about a strategy that will actually allow us to compete in some of those technologies that Nikos listed. And so we actually are starting, when we look around the hill and we look at policymakers, they're all endorsing some component of this idea of us being more competitive and having a strategy. It's just pulling it all together and saying, nope, we're going to try. We're going to decide which technologies we think we can be competitive in. We're going to put really big money behind innovating in those technologies. And we're going to try to deploy them not only at our market at home, but also try to, you know, sell those technologies abroad. And we have to do it in a way that, you know, previously would probably have made our politics a bit uncomfortable. But today, it's just a reflection of the reality of the competitive race that we're in internationally. And I think, as Nikos had mentioned, the benefit here is if it's a race to the top, right? It's a race to improve better technologies that are better for the environment, that are better for dealing with climate change, then it's not a destructive kind of competition. We could very easily get into a destructive kind of competition where we both lose the efficiencies of a free market system and a globally traded system, and we're not even trying to promote the kinds of technologies that we know are where the energy system needs to go. We've got to figure out how, through a U.S. competitive stance, we can try and create that positive dynamic in international competition. And it's not a kumbaya moment by any stretch of the imagination. It's really saying we want to win, but we've got to figure out the terms under which we compete.
I wanted to add just two brief comments on what Sarah just said to amplify them. One thing that really struck us as we were doing this research for this report is when Congress reauthorized the U.S. Export-Import Bank, it gave it specific sectors and it said, Exim, we want you to go out and make sure that U.S. companies overseas are competitive in these sectors. So we have a process where we've identified specific areas where we want the U.S. to be competitive, where we want U.S. exports, and we want the government to support companies in being competitive. And one of the things that's striking is that, you know, this list stops or starts at the shore, and it doesn't have any impact in domestic policy. So you've identified sectors where you want to compete overseas, but you're leaving untouched the domestic market in terms of how you deploy these technologies. That's number one. The second thing that we think is important and we try to highlight in the report is research and development, R&D, it's so important. The U.S. should be spending more money on R&D. If you look at other sectors where the U.S. is very competitive, it spends a lot more on R&D than it does in the energy space. But R&D is not enough. At the end of the day, we've had a lot of technologies that were founded in the United States, but they were deployed overseas. Why? Because those markets were welcoming to those technologies, more welcoming than the United States was. You know, it wasn't the shale revolution. You know, it started from the Department of Energy, but it was very expensive oil and gas that brought that into the market. The market sort of gave a price signal. So you can come up with the best thing in the lab, but if the market doesn't allow for that development, doesn't allow for that technology to be developed, it's going to stay in the lab. So sometimes we have a market strategy and market structure strategy that undermines what we do in the lab. And we need to think about how those two things align with each other much better.
I want to ask you both why this is all so hard. Is it because climate change is such a big issue? Is that why it's so hard to get a cohesive international energy policy strategy, to get the U.S. all on the same page so we can build allies and we can build relationships and we can pursue a strategy such as you're suggesting? Why is it so hard?
Yeah, it's hard for a couple of reasons. I mean, I used to say, you know, climate change went to this place that you don't want to be. You know, you can't bring it up at a cocktail party without understanding what kind of cocktail party you're at. That's not great, right? That's the sign a public policy issue has gone to a bad place. I think that fundamentally, one of the problems in the U.S. political system is our zero-sum thinking, right? If one party wins on an issue, another one loses. And quite frankly, it's to our own detriment. Folks in the private sector understand that this is a settled issue. They understand that this is where the energy economy is going. They may disagree on the technological solutions, and they may disagree on the pace or the policies we need to get there. But they understand that it's the direction. And so I think it's really an area where our politics are keeping us back from making sound policy. The other thing I'll say is it does seem to me that the United States doesn't really understand at a very sort of core level how industrial policy works within the United States. I mean, we have lots of places where we pick winners and losers or incentivize different technologies and systems all the time. We just like to tell ourselves that we don't do that. Just because you have a plan and a strategy doesn't mean that you can't have free market competition as well. You just have it within a set of guidelines. And so, you know, this is one of the advantages at being at a nonpartisan think tank. You get to say stuff that other people don't necessarily want to say. And the truth of the matter is, we just need a strategy and we need to start sort of dithering about, you know, not putting one together. But I think it's hard because people have these notions of things that government should do or should not do, but they don't recognize ways in which government is already supporting a bunch of different kinds of industry or the way that we utilize energy. And we've got to be careful because it's starting to be to our detriment not to realize that we do that within our existing policies and frameworks.
I think I agree with everything that Sarah said. So I just wanted to add a couple of points. One is one of the challenges when you think about climate and specifically the energy dimensions of climate is you need to make a switch. You use energy in one way and you need to switch to a new way. And the problem, I think, for the United States, and it's something that's become harder in the last 10 years, is because of the growth in U.S. oil and gas production, it feels like you're being asked to give up your ace. It feels like you have this trump card, this really valuable thing, that you're a big producer of oil and gas. And there's this fear of, how do I maintain the benefits of this? Well, at the same time, you're asking me to go play in this other game, which requires that I give up, essentially, eventually. I surrender the benefits that I get from being a big hydrocarbon producer. That's a really tough thing to do, and it's one of the challenges that the United States faces. The second challenge is, as Sarah said, you know, you have to think about the areas that you want to compete. And I think there's this fear. I don't happen to think that it's a well-founded fear, but there is a fear that in order for you to pull out these technologies from the lab and put it in the marketplace, you're going to do this by making energy more expensive and undermining the competitiveness of the U.S. economy. Now, again, I don't think that the evidence suggests that this is true, but it's a real fear. So you have to find a way to show that this could be win-win, that you can find a place for people that are losing to find new opportunities, but you can also make this transition in a way that doesn't undermine the long-term economic competitiveness of the United States.
Guys, before we go, I got to ask you, you've got a brand new podcast out there, and I see it's already climbing the charts on Apple. So can you tell us about the new podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for the plug, Andrew. It's called Theories of Change, and it's meant to be a forum for bringing in lots of different voices of people who think about the challenge of climate change, but from different perspectives. You know, some people think this needs to be a small R revolution. Some people think this is a technological evolution. Some people think about this from an environmental justice perspective. Some people think about it from a public policy dimension. We're just going to try and bring lots of different voices into the conversation so that we can show that while we may have disagreements about the path from here to there, there's lots of people engaged in trying to find productive ways forward.
Thanks, Sarah. Folks, don't miss this podcast. It's hot off the presses. It's got great artwork. You can find it on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to your podcast or the CSIS website. I've heard it. It's terrific. And I fully endorse it, and I can't wait to hear the second episode. So good luck to you guys with that. And I can't wait to have both of you back on Truth of the Matter to talk more about these issues. I always learn so much from talking to both of you. So thanks.
Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, check out our larger suite of CSIS podcasts from Into Africa, The Asia Chessboard, China Power, AIDS 2020, The Trade Guys, Smart Women, Smart Power, and more. You can listen to them all on major streaming platforms like iTunes and Spotify. Visit csis.org/podcasts to see our full catalog